This hour of World Watchers is made possible in part by Aries Arts in the heart of Capitola Village, serving Santa Cruz's growing consciousness for over 20 years. My name is Mae Brussel. The name of this program is World Watchers, and it is program number 847, February the 29th, 1988. Thanks to leap years, we get one extra World Watchers, and don't we appreciate that? Next week on Kazoo, there's going to be a fundraising marathon. For those of you who subscribe to World Watchers by tapes, you may not get the broadcast for March the 7th. Instead of the 1 hour of talk show that we have following the news section of World Watchers from 7 to 8, I'm going to share time with various researchers from 8 to 12, and they will tell you what they're doing, and the importance and significance of their research at this time is tremendous. David Emery will be on the telephone with us from the Bay Area, Los Altos Hills. John Judge from Washington. Barbara Honegger, here I hear from Pacific Grove. Don Fried from Los Angeles. Ted Gandolfo from New York. Bo Gritz from, he's on trial now, but he lives in Nevada. And I have three other surprises for you, depending on what their commitment is at the time. Some very interesting surprises, and they say, if possible, at that hour, because back east it's much later, and several of them are very busy, and so we have to see how the hour goes. But what I want to suggest is that if you send in your renewal as a subscriber to Kazoo this week, and say this is for World Watchers, for Mae Brussel's program, if there are 30 renewals and 30 new members, people that are listening that have never subscribed, then we can go on with the program and have 5 hours of interviews with people and talk with them and share their information with you, all live, none of it pre-taped that you've heard before anywhere else. And if we don't have the subscriptions in advance, this is a fundraising marathon, and so I'll just be able to talk to them for a few minutes and then pitch for the money for the station that keeps the station going. So I leave that up to you. And if I use that hour from 7 to 8 for the guests that I've invited, if they can be on, you people who get this tape may not get one next week because we'll have 5 hours here. And then we have to wait and see what happens after that. After that is very uncertain. World Watchers has been played on KPFK in Los Angeles for the past 4 months, at least 4 months. David Emery's program is down there too, Radio Free America. And I got a telephone call this week when the program was just about over. It played from midnight till 1 in the morning. A gentleman, I can't call him a gentleman, a person called and said, this is the last time this material is ever going to be on the air. I'm going to hop a plane and come up there and blow your head off. And there won't be a trace of you. You will be like the missing people you talk about. And I do talk about missing people. This is not what you think America is. It is similar to Argentina, El Salvador, Chile, because those death squads were formed by our intelligence community. And as I said last week, or many, many weeks for a long time, the most valuable part of my research, I think, is to have compiled the missing or the murdered that people mistook for, they did die of cancer, but for accidents, early untimely deaths, apparent heart attacks, aneurysms, and all kinds of ways that the intelligence community has bragged about the way they kill people, including blowing their head off. I've been in touch with the local sheriff, and I called the FBI. It's not anything the FBI can do because there isn't a single trace of who this person is. And, of course, you have to take certain measures of security. I learned more about this threat about my friends than I did about the man who called, because that was early morning, about 1 in the morning on Friday, on Thursday. And so during the day on Thursday and Friday and Saturday, various friends who called, or I'd called and talked to them, and I'm not talking about the people out of town, I'm talking about the local people, and I shared what happened. And it is terrifying because this man was not mincing words about what he was going to do. And of the local friends, there wasn't one single person that said, can I come to the house? You're alone. Who's going to come up the path? What's going to happen? It's a real shock that people take this as just another item that happens in the news. We're so saturated with news and events and with our own personal lives that the local people, and again, I'm not talking about out of town, there wasn't a single person between Thursday and this is Monday evening who even offered to come to the house, see what was going on, stay at the house, or in any way help with this kind of a threat hanging over me. And what I learned is that you really are on your own. And that's what I would say. John Paul Sartre says, I've said over and over, I'm an existentialist, and I've learned that the theme of existentialism is that you're on your own. You're only responsible for yourself. I created the situation, and therefore, I have to take the responsibility. If you can't stand the fire, get out of the kitchen, as Truman said. But on the other hand, I can pull out, pull back, not do the broadcast anymore. I don't know if he means Los Angeles or if he means Kazoo. We will have the program next week with the other researchers. And then I guarantee nothing. All of the things that I have said on tape are there for you. There's 10 years of tapes going back from 1977 to 1988. Everything you need to know to save your hide or inform yourself is on 1 hour a week for so many years, and tonight is broadcast 847. So you can go back a long way and study what happened. There's a lot of good books out. There's a lot of good articles. They don't make the connections. It's the connections that are dangerous. And the most dangerous thing I'm doing is talking about the connection of Satanism to the Defense Department, to the military. That is the thing that makes me a threat, because when I learned and caught on how high up these Michael Aquinos and Oliver Norths and these types are in the rituals in Himmler's castle, it put another piece of my puzzle together. And speaking of pieces of puzzle, last week when I was at Kazoo and I came home, there was also a piece of a puzzle left next to my telephone. Somebody entered my house, let me know that they could get in when I'm away, and that has an interesting long story, and I could write down for you all the things that preceded the telephone call. I was aware of seven different things that were happening before the phone call and incidents that were happening to friends and people around me that I don't think they want me to discuss on the air. I'm not isolated in this sense, but they're getting the heat also. Now, what this means is that a city like Los Angeles of 8 or 9 million and maybe, what, 3 or 4,000 listen to KPFK on a Monday morning from 12 to 1, but the entire city is held hostage to what they can hear, and you are held hostage to one man, one gun, what you can hear and who you can hear it from, and if it's not the official story, then you can't hear it. So if you think you're free, you're not. And if you listen to the past broadcasts and the things that I've said, you can figure out almost the time schedule of a lot of more things that are going to come down. Now, and besides talking about the Pentagon and the links to Satanism, and that's very important, there are three factors playing here, I believe. One is that it's an election year, and when George Bush was here on the peninsula, I told you how I was handing out information, and I called him Killer Bush, linking him to the Air Cuba that blew up, to Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt's murder, and a lot of murders when he was the CIA director. The Secret Service asked me, did I like George Bush? I said, I don't like Killer Bush. Bush is going to be the selected candidate, the former CIA director, and nobody, I don't believe, is going to be able to stand in his way. They've suppressed so much information of Bush with the drug connections, the banking connections, and with Iran-Contra. And then the Christic Institute is going to go to court in May or June of this year. And Danny Sheehan, who is physically fighting, literally fighting, I think, for his life against the likes of Sing Lao, Secord, and Hakim, who have dealt with killers so many years, that's been their profession, he's out in the line, certainly even more than me, and that is going to court. So that with Bush running for president at the same time that the Christic suit is coming down, is important. And then Mr. Walsh, the special prosecutor, is going to come in with prosecutions. And of course, I have been practically the only one in the United States continuously linking international imaging. Well, David Emery has done it too on his program, international imaging, and Albert Hakim, and the Enterprise, known as Enterprise, to Otto von Bolschwing and Helene von Damm and the Hitler Waffen SS. And Walsh's prosecution won't come close to it, but what I always do is take the parts left out of the Warren Commission, the parts left out of Watergate, or out of the Iran-Contra investigation and try to get your awareness one step beyond, that's David's program, one step beyond what you're told. So with those things coming down, it is indeed dangerous to be telling people this isn't enough. And as this country gets closer to what I call the Nazification of America, the agents that are out there are acting like Nazis. That's what happened in Germany from 1919 to the year 1933 when Hitler was officially elected and then all the laws were canceled. I wouldn't be doing this so hard, so much work, 23 years of research, 17 years on the air, if I didn't believe that it was very critical. But I realize now that I'm not going to make a martyr of myself. I've been up in the forefront of exposing a lot of these things, and I'm going to redirect my energies in other ways because, as again, I see you're really on your own, and you have to decide what your alternatives are and go in those directions. Most of you on the West Coast, certainly people in the East, didn't read the story of the lawyer, the woman, award-winning Palo Alto defense attorney, who went to a drive-in automated teller at the bank, the machine there, and was stabbed with a kitchen knife. Gretchen Burford was stabbed by somebody, either jumped in her car when she went to stop to get the money at the machine, or jumped in just at that time and killed her. She had recently gotten an acquittal for a burglary, and she also worked, I understand, against child abuse cases. And that was only in one paper, but child abuse was one of the problems. I have articles and files on news media people that have been killed and all kinds of ways of dying, and male, female, those things don't matter. In every country, the news media people have been attacked, and we've studied that or seen that, I'm sure. I pulled out just one article from my file to make a point. January the 15th, 1981, that was 7 years ago, San Francisco Chronicle report from London that journalism is an increasingly dangerous profession. Fewer than 20 countries now have complete press freedom. And that was 7 years ago, only 20 countries. And they discussed our allies such as South Korea, Turkey, Spain, South Africa, practically no freedom of the press. And, of course, the Middle East and Chile and El Salvador and Brazil and Nicaragua, Guatemala, persons exposing certain pieces of information are off, and the press people have been dying. Mexico City, there's been a spate. I think about 8 journalists have been murdered in Mexico City. There's also a run on scientists. I think the 8th scientist in London was murdered last week, and nobody is checking out just what's going on there. So the press freedoms are diminishing, and this was 7 years ago when only 20 countries had freedom of the press. Why would we think it would be different? Now, one of the most interesting stories that culminates almost a career of Ronald Reagan's presidency, and I followed it for 8 years when he was governor, are the articles coming out this past week about cueing the president, that the staff writes scripts for Reagan's conversations. You can go back to the early broadcasts I did from 1971 to 74 when he was governor of California on Ronald Reagan and follow his mental state and how he was sent to a mind control expert, several experts, to teach him little government phrases when he became the governor of California. And now Sam Donaldson and other people from the news media got a briefing of some press accounts of Ronald Reagan, and by mistake, they found the cards that they gave him that were put in the briefings that he was to give to people who he met, such as Ronald Reagan met some foreign delegation, Senate delegation, and came back from foreign affairs meeting in Europe, and written on the cue card says he was deeply appreciative of Robert Byrd's efforts. And then the script, the newspaper says the script went on that he apparently has everything written down that he says, that there was this accidental release of a detailed script of meetings, and he's supposed to say to Armin Hammer, "Can you tell me more about your efforts? Thank you, Armin, for coming here to present a report on the president's cancer panel. Can you tell me more?" And then Reagan turned to Health Human Services Secretary Otis Bowen at a meeting, and he was to ask him, "Otis, what are your thoughts?" And that was written down on a piece of paper for Reagan. "What are your thoughts?" And then he was supposed to see the Easter Seal child. He saw her, and she was at the White House. And then the script says, say, God bless you all. And Ronald Reagan was to read on a card, God bless you all. So this is a pathetic account of not only not knowing what he's doing, but actually writing down, saying to Robert Byrd, I appreciate you and your colleagues coming here today and writing it down. And they explained that it gives the president, it gives him the nature and feeling of a meeting. If they write down what he says back to them, then he knows he's had a meeting with people. Now, that is a very serious problem. And after his speech the other evening in his press conference, the San Francisco Chronicle and the wire services cat a story, White House explains what Reagan said. They always come back afterwards and explain what he said. And then the Kansas City Times had a long editorial or article. Reagan thrives on invincible ignorance. And there's a cartoon, you know, with that's all folks, Bugs Bunny, and it says that's all folks, the Reagan era. And a little person under the blanket said, I'm not finished yet. And this article was sent to me by somebody in Kansas City, and it says that Reagan is not only ignorant, terribly ignorant, but it said his genius has been to lower our expectations of presidential competence to the vanishing point. After 7 years of Reagan, we expect so little from presidents that even a gold-plated phony like Pat Robertson can be taken seriously as a candidate. The legacy of the Reagan years is that now, truly, anybody can be president. And the article goes on, the United States is essentially a commonwealth of third-rate men. That distinction is easy here because the general level of cultural information, of taste, and judgment of ordinary competence is so low. Third-rate men, of course, exist in all countries, but it is only here that they are in full control of the state and with it all of the national standards. We grovel in gratitude at the feet of Mr. and Mrs. Reagan for their efforts in fighting drugs in this country, yet we hear that the CIA supported international drug runners like Panama's Manuel Noriega and army officers in the Honduras in return for their aid in helping the Nicaragua Contras. And this is a scathing account of making the presidential standard so low. We'll accept anything. Ronald Reagan nominated a friend of Ed Meese's from San Diego to be in the U.S. Court of Appeals in San Francisco. His name is Bernard Segan, and he's getting tough questioning by the judiciary. And, of course, Mr. Biden isn't there because he had brain surgery, and he's going to have more brain surgery. And he's out of the running for asking good questions, of course. But in a two-hour questioning of Mr. Segan, they wanted to know about his opinions on the court he expressed in the past. He questioned any validity of paper money. He questioned zoning restrictions and minimum wages that are irrelevant. And he said, I'll change all my ideas if I get on the court. He came from the University of San Diego and went to University of Chicago. He said, let me be on the court, and I'm willing to change my ideas. Appoint me, and I'll change my ideas. Another article I pulled out of my file, September 9th, 1983. 1980 Reagan campaign worker reportedly admits copying pilfered Carter papers. A college student who worked for President Reagan in 1980 on the campaign told congressional investigators he photocopied stolen debate papers from Jimmy Carter, the president, to deliver to James Baker, who in 1983 was head of chief of staff, he's secretary of the treasury, Mark Ashworth, a student at Wright State University in Fairburn, Ohio, and stated that they copied, with the help of the CIA director, William Casey, and so forth, papers so that he could submit them to memory, and this is the way he did the cue cards, that the purpose was to give him papers that he could put to memory and then outdo Jimmy Carter in a debate with the stolen papers. And of course, Congress had a long investigation on that, and Reagan got off on that one. The press has been really nice to him. Rolling Stone, February the 25th, 1988, has a long article sent to me by a listener written by Francis Fitzgerald called Death of a Salesman, How Reagan Failed. And the real story is that Francis Fitzgerald, who's a good writer and research, that's the person who failed. We failed, not Reagan. He didn't fail. He succeeded. We're the people that failed because we allowed him to be. We collectively, most people, not me, but most people. And then in this article in big letters, it said from the start, the administration had a habit of bending laws to realize its vision of the greater good. It's a long article that I was going to mostly spend an hour on this evening, but I'm not, because you can get the Rolling Stone. If you can't, I'll share it with you and maybe bring out some highlights, but it's there, and even at the library, you can copy it and read it. And Reagan's problem is our problem. It's not his. It's ours. Now, I bought People magazine. The title article is JFK and the Mob, and tried to read what Judith Exner was saying about Ronald Reagan meeting with Sam Giancana. And, of course, last week I thought it would be impossible for the Secret Service and so forth not to understand that he was there. And then as I looked at it objectively and took off those rosy glasses and tried to analyze what she was saying, I don't even know if she, I think she might often really be telling the truth. I don't want to, it's hard to say it, but I look back at the company they keep, that the Kennedys keep, and why would Sam Giancana be any different than them? August of September of 1983, before John Kennedy went to Dallas, his wife, the mother of two children, is out on the yacht of Aristotle Onassis. He was the close buddy of Hallmar Schacht and Otto Skorzeny. His all-German crew of Nazis on the ship, and his wife, the First Lady of the United States, is over there. You know the reputation Onassis had. She, with Jackie Kennedy, with Aristotle Onassis, is no different than Judith Exner and John Kennedy then going to Sam Giancana. I thought of Robert Kennedy and got out the book again, The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. It was Robert Kennedy who wanted to hold the Nazis together, the I.G. Farben compound, and didn't want it broken up when it was one of the big menaces of the world. He went after Jimmy Hoffa, that's true, but that doesn't mean he went after all the mafia. Joe Kennedy, their father, was literally a hoodlum for the mafia in the terms of liquor coming in during the Depression, making money off of alcohol. And he was a ambassador to London, brought home to Great Britain, brought home because of his strong affiliation to the Nazi factions in England. And I don't know what's different with being with the Gestapo, the Waffen-SS, and the Nazis, or being with Sam Giancana for a few visits. Ted Kennedy was a Chappaquiddick. I believe, I know Mary Jo Kopechne was a victim. She was drowned. And if he wasn't driving the car, or if he knew who drove and who killed her, he kept the silence, let the murderers be free. And just because he had a good time in bed, he wasn't going to let that story break. And so he sacrificed justice for a person who killed Mary Jo Kopechne. And I think the murder of Mary Jo Kopechne is as important as meeting with Sam Giancana. And then Robert Mayhew from 1959 up through the 60s was working with the FBI and the CIA and hiring assassination committees before Kennedy had even won the election. They were setting those up, he and Richard Nixon and the intelligence community. And they were hiring Santos Trafficante and John Rosselli. Those were friends of Giancana. So if J. Edgar Hoover is giving the kosher seal of approval to Trafficante and Rosselli, then why can't the president to be with Giancana? Looking at this gory story, and this has nothing to do with a coup in this country and why the president was killed, but the company they keep tells you that to go the fine line and meet Giancana for a few more boats. After I read the article, I had to admit, and I do try to be objective, what she said seemed absolutely possible. And it would be harder to refute. There, nobody has come forward except Giancana's daughter. She said, Dad wouldn't meet with the Kennedys. He hated them. But you don't hear Ted Kennedy, or I haven't heard, or have you read or sent me an article of a single word that he's saying, of course my brother wouldn't do it. And I call that just the sleazy company they keep. And how do we know she isn't telling the truth? There may be more truth to this than we want to believe. Now, regarding the Presidio case, the child abuse case that was dropped and Michael Aquino was never charged, there was an article in the San Jose Mercury just last December called The Presidio Was Warned of Child Abuse in 1982. And this gives you an inkling of how high up the police, the military are with the satanic cult and how they can't touch them. And this is the power of Satanism and military that is really scary. The article says that U.S. Army officials at the Presidio were warned in 1982 that children were being abused at the daycare center. They failed to demand major changes until the Pentagon came in just last month and did a token investigation, which showed that everyone was not going to be charged. I mean, the people involved weren't going to be charged. This article says there was a military police investigation about the allegation of physical abuse of the children, and documents show that the Presidio was told over again this summer, in addition to the early warnings, that as many as 60 children had been abused, and that Gary Hambright, a former Southern Baptist minister, another Baptist minister like Swaggart, the voyeur, the pornography, the man who was enjoying his pornographic liaisons in New Orleans or where else, that Gary Hambright, a Southern Baptist minister, was charged, we know, with 10 molestations. They've been dropped. And also under investigation last December was Michael Aquino of the Church of Seth, the Satanic Church of Seth. And this article says that documents and interviews showed that a long time ago, the center failed to hold employees accountable for their problems. They didn't do background checks on the employees handling the children. They failed to follow the Army's regulations that prohibit taking children off the base without parents' permission. And that abuse allegedly occurred on unannounced field trips. Allegations surfaced at least 5 years ago when Gunnarsson, then Child Support Services Coordinator at the center, was arrested for an alleged assault on a female worker at the center. There was an allegation that the female person, she was the one who revealed to the sheriff about what was happening. The children were improperly touched in the groin area by employees at the center. They reported it to the Presidio officials. They were told there was nothing to look into, and Gunnarsson would be dealt with through his command channels, and that people should not ask questions. And the article brings up interviews with people who say, why? Why was it called off? Why was the investigation called up? People complained many times, and nobody was concerned. One lady said, before I left, I saw a woman beat a kid until he threw up, and I knew something should be done. It wasn't. Presidio officials were warned again of abuse by the pediatricians at Letterman Army Hospital. A memo came in 1987, signed by the chief and assistant chief of pediatrics at Letterman. Indications of abuse on children. And 8 months after the Army told parents there had been a single case of a child abuse and the children were safe and it hadn't been true, and the pediatricians suggested that they're not sure about the safety of the children using the facilities. And then Captain Mike Tobin, the one who withdrew his child from this case, said, I have 10 years experience in the military, and I've never seen Army leadership as poor as this, with the exception of Lieutenant Colonel Robert Johnson and Major General Robert Molinelli. The Army's response lacked courage. It was characterized to protect the people's professional reputations and their jobs. And Tobin, a West Point graduate, felt that the Army was covering up and that the government needed to do something. And this was going on as early as 1982 and was going on continuously. It wasn't just an overnight affair. Now, I'm going to do the second half hour on the subject of narcotics and Honduras. We've talked or heard a lot about the problem. I've mentioned various aspects of Panama, and I could do Panama for the next 10 weeks or 20 weeks, and the drug traffic in Panama. But it is getting a lot of publicity, so I want to talk about Honduras and Ollie North, because the Honduran drug connections are just about breaking into the news now, starting to come in, and the CIA and our government say it's out of control, we have no more control of it, which means that all of Central America is suddenly turning into the pockets and hands of the Medellin cartel. And keep in mind, the hero of the leader of the Medellin group is Adolf Hitler and Mussolini, and even though if you're arrested, they're still doing a very good business. I'm not going into the subject of the Middle East. A friend requested it, but I don't have to give you the score count each week of how many Palestinians are killed by the Israelis. It's on the evening news, and it's in all the newspapers and magazines, and I preferred this evening to go to the subject of the Honduran drug connections. So we'll take a 1-minute break now,